Thank you very much for the invitation. So I'm a fourth year graduate student now. And today, as Daniel said, I'll be telling you about, you know, recent updates to the distributions and individual measurements of spins of binary black holes following LIGO and Virgo's last observing run. And we had some exciting new results that were made public on Sunday. So very good timing. So to start with some background, quasi-circular binary black hole systems that are detected by LIGO and gravitational waves are characterized typically by 15 parameters. So you have the intrinsic parameters, like the masses and the spins, and then the extrinsic parameters that determine basically the relative orientation between the observer and the source. So these are things like the distance, the inclination angle, relative to the observer and the sky position. You can see a schematic of such a system here. So typically the more massive black hole in the binary is referred to as the primary. So it's labeled with M1. And each black hole also has a three-dimensional spin vector. So the magnitude is denoted by chi. And then the tilt between the component spins and the orbital angular momentum is denoted by theta. And here you can see this inclination angle between the orbital angular momentum and the line of sight of the observer. So one particularly interesting spin phenomenon is precession. So this occurs when the individual spins are misaligned to the orbital angular momentum, as you can see in this example. So in this case, the component spins and the orbital angular momentum will precess about the total angular momentum. Okay, so in addition to the component spin parameters, there are also a few effective spin parameters that are typically used to characterize spins of binary black hole systems. So one is chi effective. This is typically the best measured spin parameter with gravitational waves. It's the mass weighted spin aligned with the orbital angular momentum. So you can see how it's defined here, but basically it tells you the component spins projected onto the orbital angular momentum. And then conversely, we have chi p, which is the effective precessing spin. This is the mass weighted spin projection onto the orbital plane. And so these parameters are typically easier to measure in gravitational waves because they enter the gravitational waveform at higher post-Newtonian order. So one analogy is that chi effective is to spin as chirp mass is to mass. So again, for the masses, chirp mass is this combination of masses that is just easier to measure. Okay, so one reason that we're interested in spins in particular is because they can carry important signatures of the compact binary's formation channel. So there are two main theories for how binary black hole systems form. The first is isolated binary evolution in the field. So here you can see a schematic of this process. So you start with two binary stars, eventually one evolves and it may undergo a period of mass transfer. And then as it evolves, it will eventually go supernova and leave a primary black hole. And then there might be a phase where we can potentially see these sorts of systems as high mass X-ray binaries, where the secondary is accreting onto the black hole that has formed. And then they can go through a period of common envelope evolution where the outer layers of the secondary expand so that the black hole and the core are engulfed within the outer envelope there. And then eventually the secondary also goes supernova and leaves a binary black hole system. And it's thought that this common envelope process is key for bringing the black holes close enough that they may eventually merge in Hubble time. So in this case, because the system starts out from two binary stars, the spins of the black holes are expected to be aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And the other theory is dynamical formation. So in this case, you have compact objects that will couple up in dense environments like globular clusters and nuclear star clusters. And so in this case, the spins can be randomly distributed. So the tilts will be isotropic. So because we want to, you know, look at spin tilts in particular and to kind of distinguish between these two formation channels, if we use those effective spin parameters, this results in a loss of information. For example, if you find that the chi effective distribution is small, as we seem to be finding in current LIGO data, it'll be hard to distinguish if that's because the spin magnitudes are small or because many of the systems have spins in the orbital plane. Okay, so with that sort of background, I'll cover a few different topics today. I'll start off with an overview of what we can learn about the individual spin parameters for heavy binary black hole systems. And then I'll present some alternative parametrizations that will allow us to improve the measurements of, so for example, the azimuthal spin angles. So if you take the component spins and project them onto the orbital plane, you not only have the tilts relative to the orbital angular momentum, but you have the tilts, the angles in the plane. And then also for near equal mass systems, I'll show a new parametrization that allows us to measure those spins better. And then lastly, I'll conclude with some population level constraints, including the latest results from the weekend. Okay, so the systems that we've observed so far, it seems to be the case that the spin measurements are not very informative, both for the component spin parameters and for chi-p, so for measuring precession. Chi-effective is better measured, but as we said, that's, you know, a lossy parameter. However, recent developments in waveform modeling have led to new approximants to the numerical relativity waveforms that include the effects of both higher order modes and precession. So that encapsulates the full six-dimensional spin parameters. And in particular, one of the waveforms that I'll be using repeatedly throughout the talk is a numerical relativity surrogate model that is one of the best in terms of the physics it includes. And then in the last observing run of LIGO, we had this peculiar event, GW190521, which seemed to have a very strong measurement of chi-p that was informative and actually differed significantly from the prior. And so this begs the question of how can chi-p be so well measured for a system that is heavy and not particularly loud? So in this case, heavier systems will have fewer in-spiral cycles in the band of the LIGO and Virgo detectors. And so basically what we observe will be dominated by the merger and ring down parts of the signal that we previously thought didn't actually carry that much information about the spins. So the goal in a recent study I did with some collaborators at MIT was to see how well we could measure spins for heavy binary black hole systems using this numerical relativity surrogate model. So going back to GW190521, here you can see the posteriors on chi-effective and chi-p for this particular event. So this is just the probability distribution that we recover after analyzing the data, and the black is showing the prior. So this raises an interesting question of why can we constrain these distributions, particularly chi-p. It seems to have a lot of support for highly spinning and highly precessing configurations. So it's a relatively massive system and it's weak. So what we do is we try to replicate this measurement with simulated systems. So we simulate similar systems in a Hanford LIGO Virgo detector network at design sensitivity, keeping the network SNR fixed to 15, which is similar to the real event. And we look at a few different configurations. So nearly edge on, which is the inclination angle where we expect to measure the effects of precession the best. And this is because in some cases, you can actually see both sides of the orbital plane as it wobbles if you're looking at the system nearly edge on. And then we also, for completeness, look at some systems that are face on because we're more likely to observe systems that are face on. And then we also look at two different mass ratios, and we keep the value of chi-p equal to 0.9 for all these simulations, so very highly spinning and highly precessing. And here are our results for these different simulations. So these are, again, the posteriors for the mass ratio, the component spin magnitudes, and chi-effective and chi-p. And in this case, you can see that the spin magnitude posteriors actually prefer low values of the spin, so they're peaking at chi of 0. And if you look at the CAI-P posterior, it shows basically no deviation from the prior. So this is strange because, you know, we're looking at highly processing systems that are similar to the one that we observed in real data, but we can't seem to replicate this measurement. So maybe one way to reconcile this is that the informative measurement from GW19-05-21 is driven by the noise in the detector at the time of the event. So we can investigate this as well. We take the parameters corresponding to the point with the maximum likelihood from the posterior for GW19-05-21, and add it to 10 different realizations of Gaussian noise and 10 different periods of real data from O3A. So for Gaussian noise, it's colored by the same like detector sensitivity as was found during the real event. And so here you can see our posteriors for CAI-P in the Gaussian noise case. So in blue, you can see what happens when we assume there is no noise. And in the gray curves, you can see what happens when we add noise. So in this case, it seems to be that most of the noise realizations actually recover CAI-P posteriors that peak at the true value. And the dashed line is the prior, I should say. So there's some variation, but it's within the expectation for Gaussianity, and we are actually able to recover a very significant variation from the prior. And then if we look at real data, there's a bit more variation because, you know, LIGO data not exactly Gaussian. That is a somewhat idealistic assumption that we make. But again, there are many realizations here where we actually do recover an informative measurement of CAI-P. So this seems to suggest that the exact spin configuration can have a significant effect on the measurability. So these particular six spin parameters that correspond to the maximum likelihood point from GW19-05-21 seem to be easier to measure than the choices that we made in our previous simulated systems. We can then try to distinguish which part of the frequency band is driving the measurement of the spin for these high-mass systems. So again, we repeat our GW19-05-21-like simulation. And in this case, we're using different maximum frequencies in the analysis. So we're analyzing increasingly large portions of the frequency band. However, even though we increase the bandwidth of the analysis, we're keeping the SNR constant. So here you can see some of the different choices for the cutoff frequencies that we've used. The system merges at around 43 hertz. And you can see basically, you know, after the merger, there's this kind of like post-merger phase and then the ring down where the frequency content plateaus as a function of time. So during the ring down phase, the frequency evolution changes from the characteristic chirp behavior. And these are the results for the different cutoff frequencies that we looked at for these systems. So here you can see basically as the color becomes more blue, we're analyzing an increasingly large portion of the band. And for, you know, low cutoff frequencies, so if you're isolating the part of the signal that you are analyzing to basically just the in spiral, the spin measurements are completely uninformative. So you can see here for the component spin magnitudes, they're basically flat, and chi effective is, you know, symmetric about zero, and chi-p also is skewed towards low values of chi-p following the prior. So even for these frequencies of, you know, 45 or 50 hertz, they still basically demonstrate this uninformative behavior, even though they're technically after the merger. But then once you go up to 65 hertz and eventually when you analyze the full frequency band, so at this point you're including more of the merger and ring down parts of the signal, you can start to see a more informative measurement of the spin parameters. So here you can see CAI-P is now peaking at the true values and the component spins also favor larger spins. So this seems to suggest that the ring down part of the signal, where the time frequency evolution changes is actually contributing the most to the spin measurement for this system. So this is somewhat different from the lower mass binary black hole systems where, you know, the in-spiral dominates the spin information. In this case, for these heavy systems, we're finding, at least for this particular system that we've analyzed, that the merger and ring down parts of the signal drive the measurement. And another check that we did was we actually cut out the in-spiral entirely. So instead of analyzing, you know, the in-spiral all the way up to the merger, we just used a cutoff of like 55 hertz. And that measurement actually recovered a posterior that was nearly identical to the one with the full band. So it seems that in this case, the in-spiral really contributes very little information. Okay. So that was focused a lot on GW190521-like systems, but we can kind of generalize this and see how well we can measure these spin parameters across, you know, an entire range of masses. So for this case, we simulate systems that have a primary spin of 0.8 and the secondary is non-spinning. We simulate these systems at a reference frequency of 25 hertz. So because the spins and the orbital angular momentum precess, that means, you know, the exact value of the tilt or the azimuthal angle will change as a function of time. So you need to pick a point in the system's evolution at which you're going to measure and specify the spins. And so for these simulations, we choose 25 hertz. Which is a typical choice to just choose the, you know, the starting frequency where the LIGO instruments become sensitive. And in this case, we're looking at systems with a network SNR of 30. And we simulate a range of tilt angles, inclinations, and masses. So here the color corresponds to the tilt angle, so the lightest being align spins and the darkest being in-plane spins. And then the line style corresponds to the inclination angle. So the dotted line is the edge-on inclination where we expect to be able to measure precession better. And here this is for systems with a mass ratio of a quarter. So it seems to be the case that spins are better constrained for systems with aligned spins. So here I'm showing the width of the 90% credible interval of the posterior. So just how constrained that measurement is as a function of the total mass of the system that we're simulating. So here you can see basically the lighter colors lead to narrower posteriors. And the same is the case for the dotted lines. So as we expect, we can measure the spins better for edge-on inclinations. And then we can also compare the effect of the mass ratio. So here we're looking at unequal mass systems. And here we can see the effect for equal mass systems. So if I toggle back and forth and kind of just look at the scale, in general, it seems to be the case that the unequal mass systems are easier to constrain for the spins. And another interesting trend here is that overall, it seems to be the case that the constraint kind of gets worse as you increase the total mass of the system. So this is somewhat in tension with the idea that the merger and ring down parts of the signal drive the spin, because in that case, the heavier the system, the more dominated by the merger and ring down the signal will be. So it's possible that even though for individual high mass systems, most of the spin information comes from the merger ring down, it might be the case that having access to a longer in spiral still leads to improvements in the measurability of the spin overall relative to a system with a shorter in spiral. So that could be one possible explanation for why we're seeing this sort of degradation of the spin measurement as a function of mass. And the trends are similar for equal mass systems. There seems to be a turnover in the ability to measure chi effective, which is a bit peculiar, but this is in part due to choosing this fixed reference frequency. So one way to explain this is if you increase the total mass of the system, then the fixed reference frequency of 25 hertz corresponds to different points in the system's evolution. So what you would have to do to actually be measuring the spins at the same physical point in the system's evolution is to use a fixed dimensionless reference frequency or dimensionless reference time that includes the total mass in the scaling. And I'll show more details on the effects of that choice in the next part of the talk. Okay. And then we can also look at the measurement of those azimuthal spin angles. So in particular, phi 1 2, which is the angle between the projections of the component spins onto the orbital plane, as you can see in this little schematic here. So this angle also has implications for binary formation channels because it can indicate whether or not the binary is locked in what's called a spin orbit resonance. So for binaries and spin orbit resonances, they will preferentially have phi 1 2 equal to 0 or pi. And in this case, the value of this angle does not change in time. So basically, the component spins and the orbital angular momentum are locked in a 2D plane that jointly processes about the total angular momentum. And how this happens is for systems that form through isolated binary evolution. So you initially start out with two stars. The first one, the supernova of the first one will tilt the orbital plane relative to the spins. And you'll be left with, you know, a black hole and a star. And then if you have efficient tides in the system, then that can act to realign the tilt of the remaining star with the orbital angular momentum. And then eventually the second supernova will again kick the orbital plane. So depending on you know, the efficiency of tides and the strength of the kicks, you can end up in one of these resonant configurations. So if the more massive star is now still the more massive black hole, the resonant configurations will be drawn to phi 1 2 of plus or minus pi. Whereas if the more massive star is now the less massive black hole due to some mass transfer in the course of the evolution, then the binary black hole population will be drawn to a value of phi 1 2 equals 0. Okay, so in order to try to measure whether or not we can see any of these spin orbit resonances in the population, you need to be able to measure phi 1 2. So for our study, we didn't necessarily simulate resonant configurations, but we can still look at how well this parameter can be measured with the surrogate of waveform. So in our initial simulations, we had a non-spinning secondary object, which meant that phi 1 2 has no physical meaning. But if you look at the posteriors on this parameter and the other azimuthal parameter needed to define, you know, the full six-dimensional spins, you can see that it seems to be the case that phi 1 2 is well constrained for systems with aligned primary tilt that are viewed edge on and nearly equal mass. So it seems to be that for these aligned spin systems, the phi 1 2 value tends to be pi. And so one possible explanation for this is when we look at these systems, it seems to be that the posterior favors a high primary spin magnitude with a small primary tilt and a small secondary spin magnitude with a large tilt. So you'd need a phi 1 2 value of pi for them to cancel out and, you know, reproduce the lack of precession in the waveform. So it seems to be that this lack of precession is somewhat informative and is kind of imposing this artificial constraint on phi 1 2 for these aligned spin systems. And this is only observed for equal mass systems because in the unequal mass case, we can actually measure the spin and the tilt of the primary quite well. So there's no degeneracy like this that requires a certain value of phi 1 2. So this is sort of an interesting preference, somewhat artificial preference for this value of phi 1 2 equals pi. But we can change the simulation so that we are looking at systems that actually do have a physically meaningful value of phi 1 2. And we look at three different values, 0, pi over 2, and pi. And in general, for different values of the signal-to-noise ratio and the secondary spin, and also for the mass ratio, we find that phi 1-2 is difficult to measure at this fixed reference frequency of 25 hertz. So again, here is the width of the posterior as a function of the total mass. Here for a SNR30 system with a relatively low secondary spin magnitude. If we increase the magnitude of the secondary, there seems to be some sort of improvement in the constraint on phi 1, but still relatively unconstrained relative to the width of the prior. And then if we go towards higher mass, higher SNR systems, again, there are some points in the parameter space where we can get a better measurement of this parameter, but in general, it's difficult to measure. So I'll kind of conclude and summarize this first part of the talk. So we found that the measurability of Chi-P depends on the exact six-dimensional spin configuration. So some choices of the spin parameters, even for the same values of Chi-P, will lead to systems that are easier to measure the spins. And this begs the question, which configurations actually do lead to the most informative spin measurements? And we leave that for future work. So for GW190521-like systems, we found that the spin information depends strongly on the merger and ring down parts of the signal. And in general, we find that the spin constraints improve for systems with aligned spins, edge-on inclinations, and unequal masses, but seem to get worse with increasing total mass in the range of systems that we studied. And for phi 1-2, this parameter is difficult to measure at a fixed reference frequency. So I can pause and take questions on this sort of first section if there are any.
Yeah, may I ask a question here? Actually, a few questions I have. Can you go back to, for example, slide 10, where you, yeah, so where you try different, yeah, 10 noise, 10 different noise realizations. It seems here, distribution, right, the posterior distribution you got is quite different if you use different noise realizations. It could be that, right, whether the, I mean, you are saying that the posterior is different from the prior, but if you change the noise realization, it could be more similar to the prior. So it seems it's hard to draw any conclusion from this.
Yeah, that's somewhat true. So again, this is a relatively weak event with SNR 15. So the changing the noise realization does have an effect on the inferred Chi-P. But I think, comparing the measurement in zero noise that we get here to the ones that we got also in zero noise for these simulated systems with slightly different parameters indicates that the exact choice of the way that we've constructed a Chi-P of, 0.8 or 0.9 can have an effect on how well it's measured. So yeah, it is somewhat hard because of this variation to draw a robust conclusion about this particular event. But if you compare the zero noise cases, I think it's clearer.
Okay, so I have another question. So you were talking about this phi 1-2, and
Yes.
you're saying that depending on whether the more massive star produce the more massive black hole or not, then the phi 1-2 either goes to zero or plus minus pi. Why is that? Is there any intuition behind it?
Yeah, so it has to do with the spin of the first formed black hole is always more misaligned. So if the more massive, like if the more massive black hole forms first, then you'll have a different configuration of the spins than if the less massive black hole forms first. So it just has to do with like the, conservation of angular momentum and the exact values of the tilts of the kicks imparted by the supernovae. But it's basically due to the fact that, whichever black hole forms first, if it's the more massive or the one derived from the more massive star or the less massive star, that's going to set the overall angle here.
So I guess, I guess you just add a kick to either M1 or M2, right? So you just add a kick and then look at the configuration afterwards and see whether this is 0 pi. Is that what you're doing? Like just
Yeah, so this
yeah.
is like theoretically derived in papers by Jeremy Shipman and Davide Gerosa. So they find that certain configurations, depending on the magnitude of the kick and the tilt angle, will lead to these two resonant configurations. It just has to do with like the dynamics of the system, pretty much.
Okay, so you're saying this only holds for equal mass binary?
No, not necessarily. It only holds for systems that are formed in like this field formation scenario. So for a dynamically formed systems, you don't expect to find many of these resonant configurations.
Okay, thanks.
More questions? If not, I have two more. So one is going back again to 1905-21. So you mentioned that the KP measurement is essentially dominated by the merger and ring down part of the signal. So I was wondering what kind of waveform models you use for that and how well we actually know the precessing waveforms for that part of the binary process, so the merger and ring down.
Yeah, so we're using this numerical relativity surrogate waveform for all the results presented so far. It is the most accurate. It's tuned to numerical relativity simulations that are precessing, which I think it's unique among all the waveform approximants in that sense. And it also calibrates to NR for the merger and ring down parts of the signal. So I think it does reproduce that part of the signal with high fidelity. I think in general, the errors are within the numerical relativity simulation errors. And so we're, somewhat confident that this isn't totally driven by waveform systematics.
Okay, so sounds good. Excellent. And the other question I had, since you're showing this frequency trend here, I was just wondering out of curiosity, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but so for this event 1905-21, there have been like all sorts of alternative explanations of what else could have potentially produced a signal that looks like this. So I was wondering, so for some of those interpretations, it's critical to know whether there's actually a frequency increase or not. So I was wondering, just based on the data, how confident are you essentially just from the data that there is actually a frequency increase in the signal?
So I think that is pretty much the only part of the signal that we can measure is like this very last part where we see the chirp at the end. So I think, even if we do an unmodeled reconstruction of the signal where we just, look at a time frequency spectrogram, we can see an increase in the frequency. We don't see very much of this like slow, gradual increase for the in spiral, but we can see like the last moments of it.
Okay, perfect. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the next thing that I'll talk about is a way to refine the measurement of the azimuthal spin angles with an alternative parametrization. So as we saw previously, it's difficult to measure this parameter phi12 at a fixed reference frequency of 25 hertz. So instead, we can choose a reference point where the waveform is more sensitive to variations in these parameters. And this is closer to the merger. So we look at two different options for this in a work led by Vijay Varma. We look at a dimensionless reference frequency of the total mass times the ISCO frequency, where we're just defining the ISCO to be the ISCO frequency of an isolated Schwarzschild black hole with mass equal to the total mass of the binary. And then we can also look at a dimensionless reference time of -100. So in this case, the merger occurs at zero, and -100 corresponds to a few cycles before merger. And again, this numerical relativity surrogate waveform model is an optimal choice for this particular measurement of the in-plane spin angles because it's actually tuned to precessing NR simulations. So we can look at one particular event, GW170818, and see how these azimuthal angle measurements evolve as we change the reference frequency. So in blue, you can see the standard choice, the standard choice of a reference frequency of 20 hertz. And in green, you can see this dimensionless ISCO frequency, and in red, the dimensionless reference time of minus 100. So here you can see that in blue for phi 1 and phi 2, which are the individual projections of the component spins onto the orbital plane, it's not very informative at all. But then if you go to these reference points that are closer to the merger, we begin to see peaks in the one-dimensional distributions for phi 1 and phi 2. If you look in the two-dimensional plane here, the story becomes a bit more complicated because it seems to be that the data is individually informative about one or the other, but not necessarily at the same time. And so there are significant correlations, but in general, if you look at sort of like the area shaded by the blue, the green, and the red curves here, the area, so the uncertainty here decreases as you look at these reference points closer to the merger. Now, unfortunately, for phi 1-2, we don't seem to gain any sort of benefit from looking at these points closer to the merger. But this is also due to the fact that we are still, like the sensitivity of the detector is not optimized. So this is a relatively low SNR event that it might be the case that in the future, once we go to higher SNRs, then phi 1-2 will also benefit from this sort of reparametrization.
Sylvia, may I ask a question here? I'm always puzzled at the continuous, well, they're still choosing that F ISCO to be the one for Schwarzschild. Why? I mean, we know far better now. And if we even use the prior look at the spins of the black holes that are coming in is low, we have a pretty well-defined expression to what the ISCO frequency would be for the merger. So how sensitive is it is to that choice? Because it would, by now, would be not, I would argue, the natural choice.
Yeah, so I think the point here of choosing ISCO to just be the Schwarzschild frequency for the ISCO frequency for the system with the same total mass is just for convenience. We're just trying to pick a point that is, you know, dimensionless across total mass of these systems that's close to the merger. So this is why we also explore two different choices here. It doesn't seem...
That I understand. But I mean, if I have now two systems are coming together, say same mass, equal objects, but one system that has very high spins, I'm just going to make this up, along with the orbital angular momentum, the other one with zero spins, I end up comparing apples with oranges. The ISCO frequency that I choose for one, but if I choose the same ISCO frequency in both, because that's what you would be doing if the objects have the same mass, you're comparing two very different stages of the binary merger.
Okay, I see your point.
Yeah, I'm very puzzled at that. I mean, before we knew what would happen in the merger, I would understand it, but not now. And so I'm curious as to why the fixation of keeping that value when we could be doing better.
Yeah, so that was something that we didn't explore in this work. I think we just chose this one kind of for convenience, but that's an interesting point and something certainly I can raise with the other authors.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so we've seen that at least for that one particular system, it seems to be the case that, you know, as you go closer to the merger to measure the spins, you get an improved measurement. And so want to kind of determine what is the optimal reference point here. And here you can see the posteriors on phi 1 for six different real events evaluated at different reference times. So in the lightest color is a reference time of minus 4000 going to the darkest color of minus 100. So it seems to be the case for most of these that as you get closer to the merger, the width of this posterior narrows and it becomes more peaked. And one explanation for this is that the orbital and the precession timescales decrease as you get closer to the merger, so the waveform is more sensitive to these changes in phi 1. And another way that we can quantify this is using the Fisher information matrix. So this allows us to obtain a theoretical estimate of the statistical uncertainty in phi 1 and phi 2. So this Fisher information matrix measurement, it doesn't use any data. It just relies on the waveform. So here we're taking the maximum likelihood waveform recovered for each of these same events, and also on the sensitivity of the instrument. So this approximation really only holds in the high SNR limit, but even though this isn't necessarily a good representation of the statistical uncertainty on these parameters, we can use it as a proxy for the sensitivity of the waveform. So basically, the smaller the area enclosed by this ellipse is, the more sensitive the waveform is to these parameters. And you can see that in pretty much all of these cases, as you again increase the reference time closer to the merger, so again the lightest corresponding to the farthest from merger and the darkest the closest to merger, the area of the ellipse shrinks. And the exact direction of the correlation changes as you change the reference point, because these parameters will have different values at different points in the evolution, and the different parts of the waveform contain complementary information. So to summarize this section of the talk, it seems to be the case that the azimuthal projections of the component spins onto the orbital plane are better measured at a reference point nearer to the merger than the typical choice at like 20 or 25 hertz. And this is because the waveform is more sensitive to variations in these angles near to the merger, because the orbital and precession timescales are smaller. And just to emphasize here, we're not generating new information. We're merely asking a question that is easier to answer at current detector sensitivities. So another way to see this is we can actually get the same constraint on the phi 1 and phi 2 parameters at, you know, ISCO frequency or T equals minus 100, if we take the measurement that we get at a fixed reference frequency and evolve it forward using the numerical relativity surrogate dynamics. So this can be done entirely in post-processing, and the information is already there in the data. It's just we're pretty much projecting it into a new axis that makes it easier to see. So are there any more questions on this part of the talk before I go on? All right, if not, I'll now present another alternative parametrization that will make it easier to measure component spins for equal mass systems. So typically, LIGO-Virgo analyses sort the components of a binary system into primary and secondary using their masses. And in this case, the priors enforce that the mass of the primary is greater than the mass of the secondary. But it makes it difficult to distinguish the two objects when the system is consistent with equal mass. So here you can see an example of one such simulated system where the two components are both 40 times the mass of the sun, and the more highly spinning object has a spin of 0.8 and the secondary is non-spinning. And so you can see here that for the spin magnitudes, the measurement is highly degenerate. We seem to recover that one of the two objects is highly spinning, but we can't tell which. And the same for the spin tilt. We are able to constrain that one of them lies in the orbital plane, but we can't tell which, so we end up with this plus-shaped degeneracy. If instead we sort the objects by their spin, this allows us to break the degeneracy. So now we enforce that the spin of the more highly spinning object, which we denote with chi A, should be greater than the spin of the less spinning object, which we call chi B. And so we can resort our posterior samples, and we are able to break these degeneracies. So we now see that the more highly spinning black hole has a spin magnitude of 0.8, while the secondary is consistent with zero spin, and we're able to constrain the tilt of the more highly spinning object, while the non-spinning object tilt is relatively unconstrained, as we would expect, since the tilt isn't really physically meaningful. So we find that this sort of improvement in the resolution of the component spin quantities is, in general, found for this new parametrization for systems with close to equal spin, equal masses. And here we can see an example of how this is applied to real observations in particular. So this is what's called a spin disk plot, where the radial direction shows the magnitude and the tilt is given by the angular direction. So here's GW151226 and GW170729 using the typical mass sorting. And if we go to the spin sorting, this is what we end up. So in this case, we find that both these systems have considerable support for spins up to the Kerr limit for the more highly spinning black hole. We can toggle back and forth one more time. And we also find a similar trend for GW190521. So in this case, the original mass sorted posteriors again were pretty degenerate. It seemed to be that one of the black holes in the binary is highly spinning, but it's not necessarily clear which. But when you apply the sorting, it breaks this degeneracy. And so for these events, we find that the spin of the more highly spinning black hole to be zero is ruled out at 90% credibility. And conversely, this sorting isn't useful when you're looking at systems that have distinguishably unequal mass ratios. So for example, GW190412, in that case, you can actually measure the spin of the more massive object very well. And so if you apply the spin sorting, you end up introducing a bunch of the degeneracies that we were previously able to resolve when we applied. So just some caveats with this method. It's a very simple idea that, again, it doesn't add new information and it can be done entirely in post-processing. So we're just changing the question from what is the spin of the most massive black hole to what is the spin of the most spinning black hole. And for near equal mass systems, this it provides an improved constraint on the component spin. But this doesn't change existing inferences about the mass sorted spins or the effect of spins at all. We're not applying a new prior to existing parameters. We're just defining a new set of parameters. So again, this information is already in the data that we have. We're just pretty much projecting it along a new axis to make it easier to access. Any questions about this section before I get to the population results in the last few minutes? Okay, then I will go on. So now we can kind of switch gears and look at the distribution of spins across a population of events instead of just looking at individual events. And we can also apply our new parametrizations to get improved constraints on the distributions of those parameters. So here I'll be presenting work that covers the binary black holes detected during LIGO and Virgo's third observing run. So for events that were found in the data up to the first half of O3, they were published in GWTC2. There were 44 binary black holes. And in the new catalog, GWTC3, that includes all the O3 data that was published over the weekend, we have 69 binary black holes. And these are systems that are found with a false alarm rate less than one per year, just to ensure the purity of the sample. So for the spin magnitudes, we assume that the mass sorted spin magnitudes are both drawn from the same beta distribution. So you can see here an example of some different beta distributions that's basically governed by these parameters alpha and beta. And this is a nice choice for the spins because it's constrained to be between 0 and 1. And what we want to do is infer the values of these hyperparameters alpha and beta using all the detections included in GWTC3. And I should note that we restrict the alpha and beta parameters to only these bounded distributions, so we don't end up with any distributions that have, you know, support blowing up at the edges. So this is our result from the latest LIGO collaboration paper on the spin sorted spin magnitudes. In black, you can see the result obtained with GWTC3, and in blue, you can see the result from GWTC2. So this distribution for the mass sorted spin magnitudes is consistent with peaking at zero. There is some support at higher spins in the tail of the distribution, but really the bulk of the posterior falls at low spins. So instead, we can look at the distributions of chi A and chi B, assuming that they're the maximum and minimum of two draws from this distribution for the mass or the spin. So we're not applying a new model, we're using the same beta distribution as the overall model, but we just apply order statistics to get the distributions of the more highly spinning black hole spin and the less highly spinning black hole spin. So these are what those results look like. In blue, you can see the distribution for chi A, and it actually peaks at around 0.3. And we find that 99% of the highest spinning black holes in the binaries detected by LIGO and Virgo have spin magnitudes greater than 0.08. Conversely, for the lower spinning black holes shown in green here, you can see that the distribution peaks at zero, and 99% of the probability is constrained between constrained below 0.53. And this is interesting because it seems that these two populations seem to come from different distributions, and there actually is theory for in isolated binary evolution where the spins of the two black holes in the binary would be quite different. So if you have efficient angular momentum transport inside the star, what will happen is pretty much when the star blows off its outer layers, that will pretty much carry away the spin as well. And so the remnant that you'll be left with will be low spin or have no spin at all. And so the forced formed black hole will be have negligible spin. However, the second object in that case, it can be spun up due to tidal interactions with the compact object. And so in that case, it might actually have high spin. And so this sort of, dichotomy in the distribution of the spins of the two black holes in the binary might be indicative of this efficient angular momentum transport inside stars. And let's see, for the sake of time, I'm going to skip the spin tilts and just show you briefly the results from the azimuthal spin angles. So in this case, we're going to model the distributions of phi 1 and phi 2 as independent von Mises distributions. These are pretty much just Gaussians with periodic boundary conditions, so they're characterized by a mean mu. And in this case, for some example distributions here, they all have a mean of zero. And then there's a width sigma, which is defined as one on the square root of this kappa parameter. So larger values of kappa will, in this case, lead to narrower distributions. So for these azimuthal spin angles, again, we're restricted to using the numerical relativity surrogate since it's the most accurate for these angles. However, it only includes 20 orbits before the merger, so we can only analyze the most massive events that have a total mass of 60 times the mass of the sun, since otherwise, there are more cycles inside the sensitive band of LIGO. So we end up with 31 binary black hole events from GWTC2. And in this case, we're using the dimensionless reference time of minus 100. So here you can see the results for the distributions of phi 1 and phi 1.2 using two different priors on the width parameters. So Jeffrey's is just log uniform versus flat. And interestingly here, we find that there's a preference for phi 1 to peak at minus pi over 4. And we also find a slight preference for phi 1.2 to peak at pi. So this could be an indication of spin orbit resonance, but the width parameters are basically entirely unconstrained. So we'll definitely need more data to confirm whether or not this initial result is statistically significant. And then for comparison, we can also show the results at a reference frequency of 20 hertz. So again, just to highlight the improvement in the measurement that we get when we use those values of the reference time or frequency closer to the merger here, the distributions are much flatter. Okay, and I think for the sake of time, I will just conclude. So for the spin magnitudes, we find that the highest spinning black hole in the binary has a spin magnitude distribution that peaks at around 0.3, while the lowest spinning binary black hole peaks at zero spin. For the tilts, even though I didn't get to this, we find that they're drawn from a nearly isotropic distribution, and this provides evidence for both spin precession in the population and extremely misaligned spins, leading to negative chi-effective. And then we also find tentative evidence for spin orbit resonances, and a seemingly unexpected preference for phi 1 to peak at minus pi over 4. This is not predicted by any formation scenario, so we'll be interested to see if that peak is still statistically significant once we add more events to the population. And I think with that, I'll see if there are any more questions.
Thanks so much, Sylvia, for a wonderful talk. Questions?
Well, I'm curious about this minus pi over 4. I guess if somehow this is real, what does it mean theoretically, like in terms of formation channel or?
Yeah, this is totally unexpected and I actually don't know. So we would hopefully take it back to the theorists who could come up with something. But yeah, there are no formation channels that really expect or predict this sort of peak here. Again, it's still very tentative. So it seems to be the case that in the inference that we recover, that if the distribution is narrowly peaked, then it has to be at minus pi over 4, but there's also considerable support for it to just be flat. So this is not a definitive evidence for a peak yet, but mainly an interesting first hint, I would say.
Okay, maybe I can go back a little bit. So this is some absolute phase. So what is the phase reference? Is it a merger? Is it phi one defined with respect to, I don't know, direction of the merger?
Yeah, so I can pull up the schematic again. Yeah, it's really just defined with respect to kind of like the plane set by the orbital angular momentum and the I think it's the line of sight of the observer. So it's really arbitrary. Like this phi one is defined relative to an arbitrary point. So there's really no reason for it to preferentially peak at any value on a population level. So it's very surprising that we find this. Because yeah, it is just defined relative to an arbitrary reference point.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Hey, Sylvia, along those lines, have you guys tried, changing the arbitrary reference points? Like you could imagine doing a simulation network with different detector orientations or something like that, right? Because effectively the phase at coalescence is almost a gauge choice. And if you rotate your detectors, then you can change like how that's going to imprint through the antenna patterns. Have you guys done anything like that? Because I mean, what you said is it seems like this can't be a physical effect since it's a fixed shift relative to a completely arbitrary unphysical reference point.
Yeah, we haven't actually tried changing the reference point, but that's a good idea. I mean, we could also look at phi two. We just picked phi one and phi one two because you need to pick two of the three. But we could also look at phi two to see if there's any sort of peak there. But yeah, alternatively, just like changing the reference point from which phi one is measured is a good way to check the origin of this.
Okay, thanks. I mean, like you said, it's fascinating and very curious. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out. I also had another question, but I don't want to hog the floor if other people have questions.
Please read. Go ahead.
Thanks. So Sylvia, when you were talking about the spin sorted posteriors, you had this one plot where the smaller spin tended to be lower and then the bigger spin tended to be higher. And if I heard you correctly, maybe one more back. I think it was a 1D marginal posterior that I saw. If I'm wrong and this wasn't there, then apologies.
I don't think I have any without corner plots, but Was this for the individual events or for the population?
No, I think it was for a single event.
Okay, I have spin disk plots, but anyway, you can ask the question and I'll see if I think of the relevant plot.
Okay, yeah, apologies. It's not the first time I've made such a mistake, but I thought I heard you say something about there being evidence for efficient angular momentum transfer based on the fact that how the spins were distributed. Yes, that's the one.
Yes.
Right, okay. So the blue here is the larger spin and the green is the smaller spin, right? And I was wondering what sort of distributions do you get just basically from the prior, right? Because to me, this looks like it could be an effect of just the ordering, that the blue tends to be bigger than the green.
Yes, the blue will by definition be bigger than the green, except in the case where you had all zero spins, in which case they would line up. So yes, part of this is driven by the prior. I think it's not quite so, like the peaks are less extreme when you look at just the samples from the prior. And another way to kind of corroborate this is, so instead of, you know, assuming that both of the mass sorted spins are drawn from the same distribution, you can actually fit them with two different distributions. And if you allow those distributions, there's, you know, early ongoing work, preliminary work that finds that you can actually recover similar distributions, that these two are seemingly different, where, you know, one distribution favors peaking away from zero and the other one is peaked towards zero. So there seem to be kind of like two different parallel ways in which you can sort of constrain this that both lead to similar results.
Okay, thanks.
More questions? So maybe on this point, because I had a similar question than Reed, but so if I take this by face value and I assume this is physical, so you mentioned that, you know, there's some interpretation in terms of isolated binary evolution, but how would I interpret this in terms of dynamical scenarios in globular clusters, for example, dynamical formation channels? Or in other words, essentially, if this is physical, are you essentially telling us that most binaries would form an isolated binary stellar evolution?
I think you'd have to do something a bit more robust in order to determine that. So for example, you could imagine in globular clusters, if you have, you know, a binary that's assembled where one object is the remnant of a previous merger, then that will have high spin. And so if you have any what's called like a first generation merger with a second generation object in the same binary, then you might also recover a similar distribution to this. So again, that's one potential interpretation. It's not necessarily, it's far from, I'd say, confident that that is the explanation.
Right. But I mean, the second generation mergers, they would have like very large spins for one of the.
Yes, so yes. They peak at like 0.7. Yeah, exactly.
That would be like extreme. Yeah.
Yeah.
More extreme. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. That's very intriguing. Thanks. Okay. Any final thoughts or questions? Okay. Well, if not, then let's thank Sylvia again for a wonderful talk. And thanks everyone for attending. See you all next week, same time, same place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sylvia.
Thanks, Sylvia.